This is Viewpoint on West Virginia Public Radio. I'm Ashton Mara. It's perhaps the most expensive, most contentious race in the state this election season. The 3rd Congressional District has longtime Democratic Congressman Nick Rahal taking on State Senator Evan Jenkins in a close race. Today on our show, Congressman Rahal discusses his views on coal and diversifying the economy of Southern West Virginia, and if the ugliness of the race will keep voters from the polling places on Election Day. Later in the show, the Boy Scouts of America are asking West Virginia voters to approve a constitutional amendment allowing them to lease out their Summit Bechtel Reserve, possibly for national events like the X Games. We hear from both sides on the positives for the Scouts and the possible negatives for the competing area businesses. And we wrap up this week's political news with our reporter roundtable. Stay with us.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. New York City health officials say they're treating a patient who was tested positive for Ebola. As NPR's Rob Stein reports, officials say the man is a New York doctor who had been working for an aid group in West Africa.
The doctor who was diagnosed with Ebola in New York recently returned from treating patients in West Africa. The doctor, who works at the New York Presbyterian Hospital Columbia University Medical Center, had been volunteering for the international group Doctors Without Borders. He was rushed to Bellevue Hospital in New York and placed in isolation after developing a fever and other symptoms. A preliminary test conducted by the New York City Health Department found he was infected with the Ebola virus. City officials say the chances the doctor infected anyone else is very low, but as a precaution, they are trying to track down anyone who had contact with the physician once he developed symptoms. Rob Stein, NPR News.
The World Health Organization says it's working to speed the development of several experimental Ebola vaccines. The WHO's Marie-Paul Keeney told reporters in Geneva many experimental doses will be ready by next year.
The pharmaceutical companies developing these vaccines, as well as the ones which are a little bit longer in the development path, are committing to ramping up the production capacity to millions of doses to be available in 2015, with 100,000 ready in the first half of next year.
She said currently there are 2 experimental Ebola vaccines in human clinical trials, and 5 more experimental vaccines are in development. A Russian-born prisoner who fought with the Taliban in Afghanistan is heading to the United States. He'll face trial in the deaths of American troops. NPR's Tom Bowman has more.
The man goes by the name Eric Hamidulin, and he's being held in the Parwan prison right next to the U.S. military's Bagram Air Base north of Kabul. He's suspected of leading insurgent attacks back in 2009, in which Americans were either killed or wounded. It's not clear what charges he'll face. White House officials declined to discuss the matter, saying only the president's national security team agreed the prosecution of the detainee in federal court was the best disposition of the case. There are about a dozen foreign nationals being held at Afghanistan's Parwan prison. With most U.S. forces leaving Afghanistan by year's end, officials said the detainees are expected to be either repatriated to their home countries or face charges in the U.S. Officials said Russia did not want Hamidulin back. Tom Bowman, NPR News.
European leaders have agreed today to cut greenhouse gas emissions. Their target is set at 40% below the levels that were recorded way back in 1990. Their agreement comes ahead of international climate talks set for next year. This is NPR.
Listening to Viewpoint on West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara. Congressman Nick Rahal may be better known in his district as simply Nick Joe. He was first elected to his seat in 1976 and currently serves as the top-ranking Democrat on the House Transportation Committee. He previously chaired the Committee on Natural Resources before Republicans took control of the chamber. Congressman Rahal is a native of Beckley, a graduate of Duke University, and a grandfather of 3. Congressman, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Ashton. Great to be with you.
Before we get to our first question, I want to tell our listeners that the Congressman's Republican opponent, Senator Evan Jenkins, has been invited to do an interview on this program, but has not accepted that invitation. Congressman, there's a lot of dissatisfaction, not just in this state, but across the country with Washington right now. After 38 years, why should West Virginians vote to send you back to Congress?
Well, Ashton, I think this race in the 3rd District of West Virginia comes down to really one thing. who the people can trust, who the people can trust to stand up for West Virginia values and who will be on their side. It's very clear that I have been for 38 years standing with the people of West Virginia, fighting their battles, fighting their values in Washington, and listening to what they have to say in West Virginia. My opponent, having switched parties three times in his career and switched position on issues, I don't believe can even be trusted by his newfound party. It's hard to say which party he will be in next year. I have been one who's out there fighting for our West Virginia values, whether it's working with Republicans across the party aisle, standing up to my own party to fight back against the EPA's job-killing agenda to protect our coal jobs, or fighting to raise the minimum wage, or fighting for black lung benefits, veterans benefits, Social Security benefits. I always put West Virginia first, and I'm very proud of my record. I have been working there every day. I'm the most accessible congressman this district has probably ever had. Four district offices, publicly listed phone numbers, including home. You're just as likely to see me walking down the aisle of a grocery store in my district as you are the aisles of Congress. And I believe that type of accessibility is what we need, because being a congressperson, Ashton, is certainly more than just casting votes in Washington. It's about working and representing your people's values and working for them on a personal basis as well. And I believe that's what I have done.
So your race, more than any other, has been focused on coal and the declining industry in West Virginia. I think the voters are pretty aware of your support of the industry, but the fact is that coal is on a downswing. So can you give me one concrete example of a way you will help diversify the economy of southern West Virginia and put people back to work?
Sure, Ashton. I do have that concrete example, but let me say in the very beginning, as you said, I do support coal. I support it adamantly, and most importantly, I support our coal miners in protecting their safety, number one. They are our most precious resource, and that's why the UMWA supports me. It's been my legislation that created the largest system of federally protected rivers east of the Mississippi here in southern West Virginia. That's a boost to our tourism industry. That's a boost to diversifying our economy, which we must continue to do. We have to keep the ball rolling in these many efforts that I have made and continue to make to diversify our economy. That federal protection that was created in the mid-80s, using the New River National Gorge River as a backbone for this largest system of federally protected rivers in West Virginia, not only is diversifying our economy, but I truly believe it was the anchor that drew the Boy Scouts of America to decide on southern West Virginia as their permanent home. They bought 10,600 acres using privately raised funds to now have secured southern West Virginia as their permanent home, where the worldwide jamboree will be held in 2019. Other efforts that I'm making in the technology field and in the health services industry will diversify our economy as well. We have natural gas. We have oil and gas in West Virginia, Ashton. It's important that we recognize, while the low price of natural gas is a reason for the current slump in the coal industry, those prices can't stay low forever. And we have that resource in West Virginia as well. So we need to develop that industry as is happening up north. It has the potential to spread down south, thereby further diversifying our economy, providing jobs. But during all these efforts, I will never turn my back on the coal industry nor our coal miner.
Congressman, I want to get back to this point of tourism, bringing tourism to southern West Virginia. Is there a conflict between protecting the environment to promote tourism and mining in the region?
Not at all. No. We have proven in West Virginia that we can do both. We have done it successfully over the decades. I recall my first year in Congress when I was on the conference committee that wrote the final bill of SMACRA, the Federal Surface Mining Reclamation Control Act. That was a big question then. But we used in that federal law of 1977 that Jimmy Carter signed in the Rose Garden, we used the model that West Virginia had been doing, and that is reclaiming our land once it is surface mined, putting in the infrastructure necessary for future developments, and providing jobs for our people at the same time that we've been protecting our environment. And we have some of the most pristine mountains, most pristine air, most pristine environment here in West Virginia, because that has attracted so many tourists from around the world that have come to our state and noted that very fact. So we pride ourselves in West Virginia, being able to reclaim the land, provide jobs for our people, protect our environment, and I might add, I have one of the lowest crime rates in the nation as well. So we have the worker morale in our state. We have the availability of a very talented workforce to be able to do the job of reclamation, and we have been doing it for decades.
So I want to move on to a follow-up question from something that happened during your debate last week with Senator Jenkins. During that debate, he accused you of sponsoring a bill that was meant to reduce carbon emissions for the U.S. Capitol and resulted in a decrease of the use of West Virginia coal in the Capitol power plant. Congressman, that bill was passed in 2007. It's called the Energy Independence and Security Act. Do you know what type of fuel is used to power the U.S. Capitol, and if in fact was or ever has been coal from West Virginia?
To my understanding, Ashton, it was coal from Kentucky. But I have certainly, been fighting and wish it were West Virginia coal. I think I recall that Congressman Rogers, my good friend and colleague from across the aisle and across the river in Kentucky, if I'm not mistaken, it's coal from his district.
So I want to talk a little bit more about that bill. It set forth standards. I'll be honest, I didn't read the whole bill, but I read the overview. It sets forth standards to reduce vehicle emissions, set energy efficiency standards, not just for federal buildings, but also for industrial buildings and schools, directed the Secretary of Energy to research renewable energy resources like solar and geothermal. The bill did a whole host of things that I'm assuming that because your name is on it, you support. So do you support to some degree a control over human carbon emissions and a diversified source of energy for the country?
Well, Ashton, we should not be putting the finger solely on the coal industry or looking solely at the coal power plants as a source of all our pollution problems in this country and in this world. That's not fair to singly point out the coal industry. I do support, you mentioned renewables in this particular piece of legislation, I do support the development of all of our domestic, and I capitalize and underscore the word domestic, sources of energy. That would include solar, wind, that would include coal, certainly number one, that would include natural gas. So we need an energy policy that does embrace all of the above when it comes to developing our energy sources for our people. And renewables, I mean, I'm not against renewables, and you mentioned that bill does direct the use of renewables as well. So that's been my energy policy, and unfortunately that's not what we're seeing emanating out of the current EPA or this administration.
I want to take a quick second to remind our listeners that you're listening to Viewpoint on West Virginia Public Radio. I'm Ashton Mara, and we're speaking this morning with Congressman Nick Rahal, who's running for re-election in the state's 3rd Congressional District. Coal has been the major focus of this race, but there are also so many other major issues out there. And I want to throw you an open-ended question. What, in your opinion, is the second biggest problem or the next biggest problem Southern West Virginia is facing?
Jobs. And the third problem is jobs, and the fourth problem is jobs. I think we have to look at, as I've already noted, the diversification of our economy. We have to look at the current proposals emanating out of this EPA that have sent a chilling effect throughout the coal fields, causing WARN notices and, in some cases, layoffs. I get it. I feel the anger of the people. I can understand a laid-off coal miner being told that it was because of the EPA that he's being laid off. I can understand that person going out and doing an ad for my opponent. I would be angry as well. But it must be understood that we need somebody in the halls of Congress that can reach across party aisles to try to solve these problems. They're not going to go away overnight. That laid-off miner, unfortunately, is not going to be hired back should my opponent be reelected, nor are all the problems in the coal fields going to be solved. if my opponent is elected. It's going to be an automatic yes vote in the phalanx of Republicans, many of which are right-wing, such as the billionaire Koch brothers that support my opponent with millions of dollars in this state. We need somebody that is going to address the job issue from a bipartisan basis, who's willing to put his or her party and agenda ahead. Being able to put the people's agenda ahead of party agendas. That's what we need in the Congress. So I can face these challenges. I have visited the coal mines. I've been with our coal miners. I've been at these pro-coal, anti-EPA rallies time after time after time, again and again and again. And my opponent has never been at a one, and yet has been in the state Senate for 20 years. So speaking of Johnny-come-latelys, that's what we have in this race. It's a Johnny-come-lately who's trying to paint an incumbent who's been there his entire career fighting for our coal miners and our coal jobs, trying to paint me as an anti-coal official. It's not fair, and it's not based on facts.
I think it's also fair to say that substance abuse is a big problem in southern West Virginia. So what initiatives at the federal level would you support or continue to support to combat that problem?
Again, I joined bipartisanly on this issue, Ashton. My good friend Hal Rogers from across the river in Kentucky is the Republican chairman of the House Appropriations Committee. He and I are co-chairs of the House Prescription Drug Abuse Caucus. We have organized summits both in our individual states and on the national level that have drawn experts from all walks of life to address this issue, and has drawn individuals that are facing recovery issues and drug abuse issues in their daily lives. These type of summits are necessary. I've brought the National Drug Czar, Mike Botticelli, into West Virginia. It's been my efforts that have led to increases in funding rather than cuts in funding for the HIDA program. That's the high-intensity drug trafficking areas, which many of our counties along our borders in West Virginia need these additional federal resources to coordinate with local and state officials and to update their technologies so as to better track the bad guys that come in from out of state to do harm to our people in state. But certainly the drug crisis is a scourge that affects our economy. It affects all walks of life, whether you're 9 or 90, whether you're rich or poor, whether you're Republican, Democrat, or independent. It cuts across all of our societal lines, and we need to address it in a multi-pronged fashion. That is education. It certainly starts in the home with the parents. We need prevention programs, and we need treatment programs. So it takes all of us working together to address this issue that has so severely affected lives across southern West Virginia and our economy as well.
You were in Huntington earlier this summer. That community has been working extensively on cutting down on drug abuse. Should there be more of a focus of keeping the drugs out of the communities of law enforcement looking for and taking down drug dealers, or should there be more of a focus on treating the people with drug abuse problems?
I think we need both, Ashton. As I said, it's a multi-pronged effort. Yes, law enforcement is doing the best they can, often with their hands tied behind their back and with insufficient tools with which to do their job. You have to have that hammer, so to speak, hanging over an individual's head so that they will seek the necessary treatment, and you have to have the treatment programs available. We obviously cannot arrest our way out of the drug crisis. I think most law enforcement would agree with that statement. We need to address it at all levels, as I've said. It's more than just throw them in jail and throw the keys away. That's not going to solve the problem. That's not going to treat the addiction, the disease, and it is a disease that affects so many people across so many lines, as I've said.
So I'd like to revisit one of the questions that you were asked during the debate last week. Les Smith from the Herald-Dispatch, asked, and I'm asking you the question again, with the cost of higher education and student loan debt across the country increasing, what, if any, strategies do you think should be implemented at the federal level to control the cost?
We need to make every effort to bring down tuition costs. We know those costs are going up to our young people. We should stop this cutting and gutting of so many programs at the federal level, such as the Ryan budget would do, that the individual who supports my opponent as well is a sponsor of. We need to make Pell Grants, student loan grants, Perkins loans more available to our young people, not less available. We need to make sure that an individual can pursue a higher education regardless of his or her financial ability to do that. Student loan interest rates have been an issue in the Congress. It was we finally reached a compromise on it a while back, but it stood out there for a while as an example of the dysfunction and political bickering that goes on in Washington, because so many in the Tea Party, the right wing of the Republican Party, wanted to find pay-fors, wanted to find other funds, other programs to cut in order to lower interest rates. We were able, fortunately, to keep those rates from skyrocketing further and keep them at a moderate level, but we still need to come back and address the student interest loan possible real problem that's lying on the horizon for this country.
NPR reported on a poll over the weekend that ranked Ebola as one of the top concerns for Americans as they head to the polls next month. This week, the CDC announced that it would monitor all passengers who travel to the United States from countries affected by the virus. Congressman, do you think the CDC and the administration are acting appropriately at this point, or do you think the United States should enact a full travel ban?
Well, the CDC has fumbled the ball in the initial stages of this Ebola crisis, and that does not restore people's faith in our government or confidence in what our government says. We faced a similar problem here in West Virginia earlier this year, Ashton, when we had that water crisis, and the CDC kind of fumbled the ball there as well. I do believe they're getting a better hold of the problem now, and we have to again, address this at all levels and recognize that from the federal level, we cannot continue to cut NIH funds and attempt to gut those programs that would help us find and actually put into place the proper vaccine against Ebola. This is an issue, again, that the federal government does have a role as a partner to play in trying to resolve this crisis. So I have the greatest deal of confidence now with the administration getting all agencies involved, with Secretary of State getting our allies involved as well at the United Nations and coming up with the funding and the resources to address the Ebola crisis. I feel that we as the most powerful nation in the world can address this crisis and protect our people.
So monitoring is enough. We do not need to enact a travel ban.
I have called for the enactment of a travel ban, yes. I feel that at least right now, that restriction on travel would give us the time to get our hands on the issue better than what we have been doing.
Okay. In your debate last week, you also said of the Affordable Care Act that it's time to put politics aside, it's time to stop talking about repealing the bill, and it's time to fix it. So where do you think those fixes can and should be made?
Well, certainly there should be relief for our small businesses. Those individuals that are facing increased reporting requirements and increased taxes due to the Affordable Care Act, we need to provide them the relief, or at a minimum the time during which they can better be prepared to come into compliance with the Affordable Care Act's reporting requirements. We need to extend, as I have voted to do, both the individual and the employer mandate. Again, to give time to work out the glitches in the system that we know exist. That rollout a year ago was just horrendous. I called it that time for heads to roll. Heads have rolled, but it took some time. I have the greatest deal of confidence in the new secretary, Sylvia Matthews Burwell, a Hinton, West Virginia native, whose first job in Washington was an intern in my congressional office. I have the greatest deal of confidence in the new secretary and her ability, due to her expertise, to grasp this issue and get it working. We just cannot throw the baby out with the bathwater, because there is a lot of good in the Affordable Care Act, such as the Robert C. Byrd Amendment that makes it easier for our coal miners to receive black lung benefits, the prohibition against discriminating due to pre-existing conditions, the fact that children can remain on their parents' health policy to age 26, the closing the donut holes for our senior citizens that makes prescription drug coverage less financially burdensome upon our senior citizens under Part D Medicare prescription drug coverage. So we cannot just repeal the law in its entirety or make exceptions here, repeal except for here, because that's not feasible. That's not the way it's done in the legislative process. And again, as I said, we must get the politics out of this issue and get it working for the American people. There has to be compromise on both sides to make this law work. And I have the I stand by my initial vote to implement this, because premiums were just skyrocketing at the time. The status quo at the time we passed the ACA was unacceptable and could not continue.
In the few minutes we have left, I do want to talk about the politics a little bit. There's been a lot of negative advertising on both sides of this campaign. We alluded to that a little bit earlier, but do you think the negativity will have an impact on voter turnout come Election Day?
I'm afraid it will, Ashton. The frustration with government, the negativity that's on the airways these days, yes, it's turning the people off from voting, and that's most unfortunate, because to not vote, that does not solve anything. And when people express that frustration to me and say that's why they don't vote, I just look them back in the eye and say, look, you're not slapping me in the face when you make that statement. You're slapping our veterans in the face when you make that statement that you don't vote, because they're the ones that have fought and died for the many freedoms we have in this country, one of which is the right to vote. It's our duty. It's our duty as American citizens to vote, regardless of how frustrated or fed up we are with the system. You know, we're not the perfect system of government in the world, but by golly, we're the best. And it's most important that our own people not give up, that they continue to vote, become involved, visit with your elected officials, ask the questions, write the letters to the editors. You know, every vote counts today. I don't think I need to say that, but I guess I do have to say it. Every vote does count. Elections are closer today than they have been.
Congressman, in just about the minute that we have left, with the retirement of Senator Rockefeller this year, you become the most senior member of West Virginia's congressional delegation. So should you lose this race, will the loss of that seniority have an impact on West Virginia?
Definitely it will. That is my most fear in this race, Ashton. This race is about the future of West Virginia. It's about who's going to be in the room when we write a major six-year transportation bill early in the next Congress, as we have to do. I'm the ranking Democrat. I may not be in the driver's seat, but I work well with the driver, our chairman, Bill Schuster. I'll be riding shotgun. And with the loss of Senator Byrd, now Senator Rockefeller, and Congresswoman Capito leaving her seniority in the House of Representatives, for a small state like West Virginia, you better believe seniority matters. This is not about Nick Rahal. It's about the future of West Virginia and who's going to be in that room when we write a major transportation bill. Who's going to be in the Congress working across party aisles to ensure that our state has a say, that our state is going to be, that our working families in this state are going to have a voice when it comes to future representation in the Congress.
Congressman Rahal, thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Ashton. Enjoyed being with you.
You're listening to Viewpoint on West Virginia Public Radio. I'm Ashton Mara.
Support for Viewpoint is provided by AARP, providing real possibilities to its nearly 300,000 members in West Virginia. On Facebook at AARP West Virginia or online at aarp.org/WV.
When voters go to the polls in November, they'll be deciding some heated races across the state, but they'll also be asked to vote yes or no on an amendment to West Virginia's Constitution. You may have seen the ads on television or heard them on the radio asking you to support Amendment 1 and support the Scouts. But some in Fayette County, where the Summit Bechtel Reserve is located, are concerned an amendment may put the Scouts at an unfair advantage over area businesses. Joining us today to discuss the constitutional amendment are Gary Hartley, he's the Director of Community and Government Relations for the Summit Bechtel Reserve, and Matthew Wender, he's a member of the Fayette County Commission. Gentlemen, thank you both for being here this morning.
Thank you.
Let's start with you, Mr. Hartley, and a very basic explanation of this amendment. What are you asking the voters to consider?
Good morning, Ashton. The Boy Scouts of America did a national search for a permanent home for the Jamboree, had 80 proposals from 28 different states all competing to get this project, and we ended up buying 10,600 acres in Fayette and Raleigh County, West Virginia. When we built out the site, we knew it was going to be a good site, but it actually turned out to be a great site. We ended up with a number of areas, you know, for camping, as you would expect for a Jamboree, but we also added a number of outdoor venues for things like mountain boarding, canopy tours, zip lines, shooting sports, BMX, skateboard park. These areas turned out to be nationally recognized world-class venues, and we're now getting interest in using these venues for other activities. When we committed to West Virginia, we also said we would try to open this area up for use, but we ran into a hitch, and that was that under the current laws as they're written, if we were to lease out this property, we could lose our charitable use property tax exemption. This amendment will actually help fix that and allow us to lease this property out on a limited basis for those special types of events.
So let's talk about those types of events in a little bit more detail. Has there been any interest in using the Summit, and what kinds of things would it be used for?
Yes, there has. We have had several people interested in using this event. We actually had the United States BMX Association on site looking at it, and they are really impressed with the facility that we have out there. We also have things like the Aaron Spahn, who helped build our skateboard park. This is one of the largest, if not the largest, skateboard park in the country, is interested. In fact, he said that recently, they're moving forward to have skateboarding as part of the U.S. Olympics, and that he could see things like Olympic training and Olympic qualifiers being done at this property. That's the same with the skateboard park. We also have a large stadium that'll seat 80,000 people, and our stadium could be used for other events on a limited basis.
So what kind of economic impact might we see from events like this in that area?
When we throw a big event, there's the ramp up, the event itself, and the ramp down. A good example is the Jamboree. When we threw the Boy Scout Jamboree in 2013, you know, we spent over $2 million in the local communities around us, just direct spending from the Boy Scouts of America, building up for the Jamboree, preparing for it. These events would bring people in to the event itself. It would bring folks into local hotels, motels, restaurants. We would still also collect, you know, sales tax, wage taxes, the hotel motel taxes. All those would come into our local communities if we were able to run big events on this property.
So, Mr. Wender, I want to bring you into this conversation because some of the things Mr. Hartley is saying sounds pretty great, but you're saying there's still some concern in the community about what this could mean for them. Let's talk about those concerns. How do you feel about this amendment?
Okay. Well, first, Ashton, thanks for hosting this discussion. I think it's good and beneficial to the folks in West Virginia. I think there are two big concerns back home, and hopefully these concerns are statewide. This ballot initiative is called the Nonprofit Youth Organization Tax Exemption Support Amendment. While that's quite a broad title, in fact, the only organization that benefits is the Boy Scouts of America. It's been their interpretation that there's too much ambiguity in state statute and case law interpreting that, although I would say that matter is widely debated. Nonetheless, the Scouts have concluded that it is in their best interest to clarify this matter for their singular benefit by amending the state's constitution. Never mind that the Girl Scouts, 4-H, Red Cross, YMCA, and a host of other nonprofits will continue to dwell in the same uncertainty of what they can and can't do. I feel strongly that no organization should have the people's constitution rewritten for their private needs. And to do so is to privatize our Constitution for the benefit of a select group. So if this matter does require a constitutional amendment, then let's clarify the issue for all nonprofits, not just the Boy Scouts. Now, as for the second concern that I have, and it's shared with others, let's just suppose, for an example, that the Scouts were to build 100 cabins for the use of Scouting executives, guests, or others. With passage of this amendment, they can rent out those cabins, along with the other facilities that Gary has mentioned. Now, I don't think it's necessarily the initial intent of the Scouts to compete with private enterprise, but what I do know is that Scouting has declined by about 25% since 2002. And what if that trend continues? And let's now assume that maybe the revenues generated by Scouting are not sufficient to pay the cost of operating and maintaining the summit facility. What choice will the Scouts have but to compete aggressively in the marketplace to generate additional revenues to sustain the summit? Certainly, they'd be competing head-on with private enterprise in the county that operates cabins, and there are many of them. But mind you, that it's the private enterprise that pays the property taxes that support the fire services, police protection, and our county school system. The Scouts would not be subject, currently are not subject, but they would not be paying anything for this police, fire, and school cost. They would have immediate competitive benefits, an advantage over private enterprise, that if they needed to undercut the market price for lodging or anything else, they certainly have the basis from which to do that.
So I think we should explain, though, that if this amendment should pass, there's then this piece of follow-up legislation that sets forth rules and kind of regulations for how you all can use this facility.
That's correct. When we were moving towards a resolution to this problem that we face, we worked with our state legislatures. We actually worked with our legal counsel, both in the governor's office, with the tax department. They recommended that we move forward in this direction. We worked with our legislature, both in the Senate and the House of Delegates side. And when we brought this forward, they actually were concerned about protecting local businesses, and so are we. So they've made a second part to this piece of legislation, this amendment, and that is that it does not go into effect until the legislature passes rules and regulations that will govern how much we can use the property, types of activities. It'll set up guidelines for us to protect local businesses from unfair competition. And we thrive in a competitive environment. We thrive in an environment where our local businesses are doing well. We'd like to work cooperatively with our local rafting companies and other businesses. We find that, you know, when the community thrives, we thrive. And to us, that's really important. And we're not here to, you know, to be a commercial enterprise competing against the local businesses. We're primarily a youth organization. We want to do our youth programs, run our scout camps, and be scout-centric in just about everything we do. But this amendment will allow the Summit Bechtel Reserve to be utilized on a limited basis for other types of events in the off season, you know, when we're not using it, you know, for our scout programs.
So, Mr. Wender, if this amendment should pass, what types of things do you think need to be included within those rules to protect the businesses in your county?
Well, Ashton, if you don't mind, I'd like to back up just a minute and add to what Gary just spoke about. If this amendment passes, the elephant's two-thirds into the tent. The language would then be written that starts to put limits on what the Scouts can and cannot do. I had suggested when this bill this resolution was first introduced that perhaps that was the time to start writing this language outlining what the Scouts could and could not do. The Scouts vehemently opposed that, and it went nowhere. Now, as for the last part of this legislation that is in the amendment that protects private business from unreasonable competition and allows the legislature to enact enabling legislation, that came about only after this passage of this was delayed for a full day because the Democrat caucus in the House all of a sudden decided that there were two sides to this issue. That's when this language was put in, and it was put in necessary to convince some who were all of a sudden hesitant to go ahead with the passage of this bill. So it wasn't on the front end of this process. It very much came late in the game. Now, you asked me what I would like to see as far as limits.
Yeah, what would you like to see in those rules?
Okay, well, I think we need to get very specific. I think that if this, in fact, does pass and the process starts for this enabling legislation, that they need to be very specific about what they do and do not allow. And if, in fact, as the Scouts claim, that it's all about X Games and concerts and things like that, things that would add to our economy, then let's write it very specific to them being limited to just those activities. I think you'll find that the Scouts will push back very hard against any restrictive language, but that would certainly be something that could benefit our county, our southern West Virginia region, without doing harm to our private enterprise. I would hope that that would, in fact, be the pure intent of the Scouts with this effort.
Mr. Hartley, how do you feel about that?
I feel that we're certainly open to working with our elected officials to move forward on this issue, and we certainly would embrace, guidelines, as we've said before, that would help set some sideboards up as to how we move forward with it. This certainly can be a win-win, for the county, the state, and the Boy Scouts of America.
Now, I mean, maybe this isn't me playing semantics, but you say you're willing to work with your elected officials, but are you willing to work with the community and the business owners as well?
Oh, you bet. We have a tradition of working with our business owners and in the community. A good example is like we contract out our whitewater rafting. We try to offer every scout that comes to the summit a trip to go whitewater rafting. We've worked with our local rafting companies so that we actually book trips on Monday through Thursdays when they have their slack time. And that's great for them because we pick up the slack time. It's great for us. They run the whitewater rafting programs. It's a good partnership between us and our local businesses. We like to continue to work that way and see those win-win situations.
So you don't necessarily see this amendment as something that could hurt the community businesses like Mr. Wender does?
No, we are not out to compete with local businesses. We are primarily a scout camp doing youth programs. We want to continue to do that. We feel that we can utilize this property in the downtime for other events and activities that would bring more business to the area, and a rising tide will float all boats. We can bring more to this area. We can create more jobs. It'll be more income, for the county, the state, for this entire region.
So we have just a few minutes left, and I want to give each of you a final say. So, Mr. Wender, why should the people of West Virginia vote no to Amendment 1?
Well, I hopefully I'd point out two reasons. One is, do we need a constitutional amendment to do this, when perhaps a test case, a friendly test case, could have resolved the issue? The second is that if broadly written and broadly interpreted, this could very well hamper, impede, even risk the livelihood of those who are in private enterprise, and those are the folks that pay, again, for our county government, our county school system. I would disagree with the comment that they've been open to a dialogue with the community. This bill was introduced in 2013. It didn't pass. There was no conversation with the business community or the community at large about the consequences of this or what the Scouts had in mind. It became quite a dormant issue over the next summer, but it was again introduced last year in 2014, successfully introduced. But again, there were no conversations that took place in Fayette County amongst businesses or the community. And as the final bill is written, that is not the way it started out. It was much more broad in intent, much more latitude in terms of what the Scouts could do. And it certainly did not include any enabling legislation that the legislature could visit in setting limitations on those abilities of the Scouts.
Mr. Hartley, you have the final minute. Why should West Virginians vote yes for Amendment 1?
First off, this amendment will not cost the state or the county anything. You were a 501c3 charitable organization. We will continue to be that way. And there won't be any increase in taxes and certainly no revenue loss to the county or the state. The second part is that if we bring more business, more events into this area, it's going to be a win as far as, there'll be additional business in the area. Folks will stay in hotels, motels, restaurants. We'll collect more sales tax, state wage tax, the hotel motel tax. And the third part of this is that when we bring folks in and show off West Virginia, people are going to get to see how great a state this is. It'll be a win for the state of West Virginia. It'll be a win for the Boy Scouts. This is a win-win-win scenario.
Gentlemen, thank you both for being here this morning. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Viewpoint on West Virginia Public Radio. I'm Ashton Mara. Every week, we look to reporters from across the state to give us a wrap-up of the latest political news. Joining us today, business editor from the Charleston Daily Mail, Jared Hunt, who's been filling in on the political beat. Jared, thanks for being with us. And Mandy Cardosi, State House reporter for the State Journal. Mandy, thanks for being back with us this week.
Thank you, Ashton.
So let's start with Congressman Ray Hall and the race against Evan Jenkins. Jared, anything surprising about what he said this morning?
Well, maybe I shouldn't say surprising, but one thing you asked him, I think a pointed question about, you know, what are you going to do to diversify the economy in southern West Virginia, given coal's troubles? And he came back with, well, we need to support the coal industry, and then talked a little bit about, you know, helping to create a river system and boost a little bit of tourism, then came back to, but we also need to support the coal industry. And it's just, it's one thing that's always struck me about the politics in that race. You know, it's not anti-coal to say we're going to diversify the economy. You know, coal's a bedrock of that economy, literally, but it goes through swings and cyclical downturns. You know, you've got natural gas there, but I'm surprised he didn't say more about, you know, like the technology investments or the infrastructure investments, maybe that could go into that community just to help boost the economy and diversify it. And, you know, there really hasn't been that conversation. I'm not going to say you're going to get more from the Republican side on that right now. Everybody's talking about coal, but it just seems like you're doing a disservice to the district to not also go further into what you can do to diversify that area.
So that's why we don't get direct answers to that question, because when we talk about supporting other industries, it looks like it's hurting coal?
Well,
maybe?
I don't think anybody's been able to sell it like that. I mean, it's like I said, it's not hurting coal to say, you know, we're going to create jobs in other areas. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he also talked about boosting Pell Grants and, you know, education opportunities. Well, what happens when you know, send somebody to college and they get a degree? They want to come back to the area. If all you've got is coal, they're not going to be able to stick around. Right. I mean, they're not going to get a job in a mine or, you know, lead whitewater tours with an advanced degree.
Right, right, definitely. So as far as advertising goes in this race, it's gotten uglier and uglier every step along the way. So, Mandy, you wrote this week about a political action committee that put out a new ad against Ray Hall, but the committee had tried to work with him at first?
Right. They invited Ray Hall and Jenkins both to a meeting where they wanted to talk to them about the outside spending in the race. They're calling it the dark money. And they've been known to go after, it doesn't matter what state or what kind of race it is, they've been known to go after anybody who doesn't recognize them. They've said in the past that they had the money and they had the means and they didn't like to be ignored. So Ray Hall didn't show up to a meeting that Jenkins showed up to, and they said, we're prepared to come after you. We're prepared to, you know, do this attack ad. And he never responded. So they released the attack ad yesterday, and Ray Hall's campaign says that it was his idea to stop the outside spending, to sign something with his opponent, Evan Jenkins, to say that it's getting out of hand. But it's, I mean, nobody really knows where, like, who is going to be on whose side and where it started to come up with this pack.
Right.
But they just want it to be resolved.
So I guess for clarity, you know, the agreement was never made. This pack is saying, well, we tried to get you in on this deal, and now that you're not, we're going after you. But Jenkins hasn't denied that money, that outside money either.
Right. And he said that he's brought something to the table. And I think the thing with what they're saying is that Jenkins is a little bit more eager to show up and eager to try to participate in coming to an agreement. They're not saying that they would agree with what he would come up with, mm-hmm. but they're saying even like the fact that he's listening to them is reason for them to go ahead and not be as forthcoming with him, but kind of going into the attack mode against Ray Hall.
Okay, okay. So I want to move on to probably the biggest political story of the week, and that's Secretary of State Natalie Tennant's little mishap when she went to early vote in Kanawha County. Mandy, you covered that, so tell me what happened.
Yeah, so basically she was cheering and possibly campaigning outside the Kanawha County Courthouse. Nobody really knows for sure if she was violating election laws, but Capito's campaign said that she was violating her own Secretary of State guidelines, that electioneering is prohibited during early elections within, it's 300 feet on election day, and During early voting, it's anywhere on any courthouse or
property. Yeah.
Property. So they're basically saying she's taken another step to kind of not fulfill her duties as the Secretary of State.
So I think, I mean, what happened was she gathers all these supporters to go early vote with her. She makes sure that they leave their signs across the street. They walk across the street. She walks up on the steps, turns around to, I think, thank them for coming with her that day. But I've seen the video and doesn't really say anything about, you know, let's vote for Tenet when we get inside. But still, there's this question of, you know, what exactly happened and does it violate any electioneering laws? But Jared, what are the implications of this for her campaign?
Well, you're talking about a Tenet campaign that, you know, they've been down in all the polls. They needed to run a disciplined, you know, message-driven campaign. And something like this is just, you know, takes the air out of the room, you know, completely distracts them from their message. And, you know, it also works to discourage the base. You know, they see something that's, you know, not very favorable for their candidacy. And this is an election where, you know, Democrats need to come out and vote Democrat. And, you know, if you have any discouraged voters, you know, they're going to stay home. It's going to help Republicans. And that's not going to help in some of these down ticket close races either. But, you know, it also, you know, as Mandy said, it sort of plays into a Capito campaign line that, you know, she's not doing the job she's got well mm-hmm. right now. Should she be given a promotion? So, you know, it could just completely distracted from what the Tenet campaign needs to do to make this race competitive.
Right. That Capito message came up during their televised debate, and that was right after the Supreme Court ruling on her leaving a candidate off the ballot for the 35th. But, you know, she said yesterday that she'd ask the Attorney General to look into the incident. Do we know that there's something that the Attorney General's office can actually do?
Well, no. When she was initially elected, there's an agreement, I guess, that was filed that, you know, if something happens with her, the Attorney General's office would take over the Secretary of State's office role. Mm-hmm. But as far as I know, electioneering on Election Day is like a misdemeanor punishable by a fine. I'm not exactly sure what the early voting penalty would be. One of the codes says, you know, the sheriff can just tell them to stop. But mm-hmm. And if anything, the damage is just the damage to the campaign message.
Right. But usually when allegations come across, I mean, you look to the Secretary of State's office to kind of clear those things up. And we can't do that right now.
Yeah, we know that she said that she would she would completely cooperate with any investigation. But we don't know if there could be an investigation. And it's just really unclear if the Attorney General's office would have any reason to look into what happened. And we know, at least for now, that they aren't.
Okay. Well, Mandy and Jared, thank you both for being with us this morning.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Viewpoint is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia political news by following our show on Twitter at ViewpointWV or on our website, wvpublic.org. Our theme music was written by Matt Jackford. Our producer is Beth Voorhees. Our director is Bob Powell. I'm Ashton Mara. A reminder to our listeners, early voting around the state began Wednesday. This is Viewpoint on West Virginia Public Radio.
Support for Viewpoint is provided by AARP, providing real possibilities to its nearly 300,000 members in West Virginia. On Facebook at AARP West Virginia or online at aarp.org/wv.